Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 1st, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on the Mekong Plaza and the Mesa's Asian District. Then we'll move on to a story about student scholarships and then Valley and State news, ending with national and world news from USA Today. So our top feature article is entitled Like Home, with the subtitle Mekong Plaza Transformed an Entire Neighborhood in This Valley City. This is by Raya Lee. Cecilia Buchanan held up a package of round green fruit. Are these jujubes? She asked Walai Lai, the owner of Wingley Exotic Fruits Market, which specializes in fruit and snacks from Vietnam. Lai told her that the fruit was actually Vietnamese water apples, which look similar. As he rang up her basket of mangosteen and dragon fruit, the two chatted about wanting to visit Saigon. Buchanan, whose mother is Vietnamese, lives in Santan Valley, but makes the hour-long drive to Wingley approximately every 3 weeks to stock up on groceries. This is the only place I get authentic Vietnamese imported stuff, Buchanan said. My family is very strict on only sticking to Vietnamese stuff. So even though one of my grandmas is gone, I still wouldn't shop anywhere else because I feel like she'd be watching me. Lai's shop is in a strip mall filled with other Asian businesses, like a Korean barbecue restaurant, a Chinese traditional medicine store, and a boba shop. If he props open the front door of his store, he has a direct view of Mekong Plaza across Dobson Road. Just north on Dobson is Korean superstore H Mart, flanked by a variety of Asian businesses like a Korean corn dog restaurant, a clay pot rice restaurant, and an anime bookstore. Even more restaurants and shops radiate out from the central intersection of Dobson and Main Street. In a suburb with a population that's only 2.4% Asian, this is remarkable. In Arizona, this is the only place like this, said Eugenia Chu, who runs a tax firm tucked inside Mekong Plaza. The area has become known as the place to go in the valley for Asian groceries and entertainment, first informally and then formally, with the creation of a trademarked Asian District brand by the government of the city of Mesa in 2020. What many don't realize is how quickly the area grew. From 2008, when Mekong Plaza first opened with two-thirds of its available spaces sitting empty, to 2025, when the two-mile corridor is home to 100 Asian businesses. The development has gone crazy over there, said Donald Hawk, a James Beard Award semifinalist and chef at Valentine Restaurant, who grew up a few miles down the road from the area. It's changed quite a bit. Mesa's Asian District isn't the first Asian American space in Metro Phoenix. The Asian District is part of a long legacy of concentrated Asian American spaces in Metro Phoenix, although it is also distinct. Phoenix never had a true Chinatown in the same way that other major West Coast cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco do. The Chinese population was simply too small. Phoenix's first Chinese immigrants, who'd come to the city as workers on the Southern Pacific Railroad, opened restaurants and laundries on First and Adams Streets. In 1895, white businessmen pushed for the expulsion of all Chinese people in the area, forcing the community to move three blocks south to an area that became known by many names: the Deuce, for the produce sold there, the Warehouse District, for the industrial buildings, and eventually Chinatown, although that term obfuscated the fact that Chinese people were never the majority of the neighborhood's diverse population of Mexican, Black, and Diné residents. Chop suey restaurants and Chinese-run markets anchored the area until the 1990s, when the city razed it to build a basketball arena for the Phoenix Suns. A single business, Phoenix Produce, is all that remains from that era. Even before demolition began, Chinese residents, along with many others, had begun moving out of downtown. Evangeline Song's family was one of the last families in the area by the 1950s. This was a conscious decision to assimilate. We did not want to create a Chinatown here because of the racism, Song said. As Chinese residents scattered around the valley, for a while there wasn't a visibly Asian American space, said Tony C., an Asian American entrepreneur and the founder of Local Buzz, a social media app highlighting Phoenix businesses. This was a missing gap, like a forgotten era, when people left downtown and moved on to suburbs, C said. Then came Mekong Plaza. Mekong Plaza was the forerunner of the Asian District. Mesa became one of the centers of Asian American life in the Phoenix area somewhat arbitrarily. The neighboring cities of Chandler and Gilbert have much higher percentages of Asian and Asian American residents, 11.4% and 6.6% respectively, compared with Mesa's 2.4%, according to 2023 census data. Mesa is a unique case. It's not a known tourist attraction. It's not known as attracting upper-class Asian immigrants and Asian American professionals, said Wei Li, a geography professor at Arizona State University who studies Asian settlement patterns. So why Mesa? The short answer, land was cheap, and two developers saw an opportunity. A Motorola semiconductor chip factory at Dobson and Broadway closed in 2001, causing the area to lay fallow for many years, according to a 2016 article in The Republic. Nearby stores, including Costco and Target, were shuttered. Ryan Winkle, a community organizer who helped lead the drive to create an Asian district brand, worked at that Target when he was a teenager. Mesa was very sleepy, Winkle said. Growing up around that place, we would just skateboard. That empty Target caught the eye of Philip Ta and Peter Quach, who were working as developers in California when a mutual friend introduced them. They partnered on a project in California, but it fell through. Looking for new ideas, they turned to Arizona. Ta, whose family immigrated to the U.S. as refugees from Vietnam, had briefly studied architecture at ASU in the 1980s. He dropped out when he realized that he could learn on the job instead and moved back to California. But his time in Arizona remained in the back of his mind. I always wanted to develop an Asian plaza here in Phoenix. Back then, there was no significant location other than a Chinese cultural center, Ta said, of the shopping plaza that was built in 1997 by a Chinese real estate company. Complete with tiled roofs mimicking the Forbidden Palace in Beijing and a Chinese-style garden, the Chinese Cultural Center was a landmark for 20 years before a Scottsdale-based real estate investment firm bought the complex and stripped it of its Chinese elements. When Ta and Quach visited Arizona to scout out a location, they gravitated toward Mesa, where the price of land was cheaper than in Central Phoenix, or even Chandler and Gilbert. The abandoned Target in particular was close to multiple freeways, allowing potential customers from Phoenix to reach the plaza in around 20 minutes, a magic number, Ta said. Within 20 minutes, no one really has a problem. They bought the building. Inspired by an indoor shopping center in San Jose, Ta drafted a design with wide, air-conditioned corridors leading to a mix of small storefronts, a necessity, he noted, to break up the huge space originally intended to house a single big-box store. Mekong Plaza opened its doors in October 2008, with just 10 businesses and a plaza designed for around 30. It was hard at the beginning. You can imagine back then there's only like 5 Asian businesses here, Ta said. Mekong Plaza had a slow start. When Mekong opened, it was pretty empty, said Matthew Ma, who opened Happy Bows with his parents inside the building in 2019. Doing so was a full circle moment for Ma, who grew up in Gilbert. His very first job was working at Mekong Palace, the dim sum restaurant inside the food court. Over the years, he saw the plaza grow. By 2014, the complex reached full occupancy for the first time, Ta said, and the influx of Asian businesses wasn't limited to Mekong Plaza itself. Lai opened in 2011, 3 years after Mekong Plaza, because he felt confident he could attract the supermarket's customers. Lai stocks products that he knows Mekong Supermarket doesn't always carry, like snacks and drinks imported from Vietnam, and fruits that vary based on season, such as rambutan, longan, and jujubes. Though his shop is now surrounded by other Asian businesses, when Lai first opened, he was the only one in the strip mall. Empty. The whole plaza. Nobody wanted to open anything because it had been dead for a long, long time, he said. The birth of an Asian district. Despite the growth around Mekong, farther down the street, many buildings remained empty well into the 2010s. Grace Liu opened a Taiwanese boba and snack shop called ET Tea and Popcorn Chicken with several business partners in 2022. When she first chose the location in 2018, she noticed that the surrounding strip malls had vacant storefronts. Only Mekong was open, Liu said in Mandarin. We didn't have any concept of a special Asian district at that time. In 2017, the corridor was identified by Mesa's city government as a redevelopment area, or, in other words, an area that obviously needs assistance, said Jay O'Donnell, Mesa's director of economic development. To qualify, an area needs to have a certain number of properties that are considered slum or blight, O'Donnell said. In brainstorming ways to help the area, city officials realized that the Asian businesses represented an opportunity. In their report, they specifically said there is a clustering of Asian businesses that is really unique to Mesa and that should be marketed, O'Donnell said. That report launched an initiative to brand the area with a name and logo. For Winkle, this branding was the culmination of years of effort. In 2012, he helped create a small wonders map of Mesa with a Local First Arizona, which promotes local businesses. He included Mekong Plaza on it. Then, in 2016, as the chairman of the Arizona Asian Chamber of Commerce, he and Vicente Reed, the chamber's then CEO, gathered a group of business owners to talk about how to better promote the area. I pushed a lot of effort into the district as a named place, Winkle said. It was already happening, but when it had a brand, that's what really kicked it off. Just don't call it Chinatown. In 2019, Mesa's Office of Economic Development put out a public survey with a list of options for the brand name. A 2019 Republic article about the survey quoted Dalit Nguyen, a community member who was excited the area finally had a name. For the longest time, it's just been, hey, that's where all the Asians go, he said. Before putting out the survey, city officials asked Lee's opinion. When the idea of Chinatown was suggested, she was emphatically against it. Normally, Chinatown has historical roots, Lee said. My entire work is pretty much against calling contemporary places Chinatown. Chinatown was also often used pejoratively, with negative connotations of uncleanliness. For example, an 1895 article in the Arizona Republican described the campaign to force Chinese immigrants out of the First Street neighborhood, stating, "A fine business block will rise where now exists that noxious nest known as Chinatown." Just as important to Lee is the fact that Chinatown does not accurately describe the function of the Asian district, which is commercial, not residential. Lee explained that rather than comparing the Asian district to historical Chinatowns in LA or San Francisco, a better comparison would be to Las Vegas's Chinatown, which is a series of strip malls with Chinese and other Asian restaurants located a few miles west of the strip. In both cases, they started as commercial centers, Lee said. It also would be a misnomer, as the businesses are owned by and aim to serve people from a variety of countries and ethnicities across East and Southeast Asia. Ultimately, the succinct Asian district was chosen. The Asian district brand debuted in 2020 at the first Asian Night Market, held in the parking lot of Arizona International Marketplace, which Quatch opened in 2016 after the success of Mekong and has since closed. Getting international attention. A major turning point for the Asian district was when H Mart opened in 2020. The Mesa store is the only location of the popular Korean and Pan-Asian grocery chain between Texas and California. Multiple employees at various businesses in the Asian district pointed to an uptick in business after it opened. Ma said he specifically noticed more non-Asian customers frequenting his restaurant. H Mart hasn't hurt our business. It's kind of just extended it, said Drew Bertoni, Quatch's son-in-law and the development manager for Mekong. Other national and international chains have followed suit. A franchise of Taiwanese boba chain Jingfu Tang opened in 2010, followed by Japanese restaurant Mensho Ramen in 2024. The Thai boba chain Fire Tiger Dessert Cafe opened its first location in the U.S. in the Asian district in 2022, although it has since shuttered. The popular Chinese hot pot chain Heidi Lau is set to open its first Arizona location at the Mekong Plaza expansion this summer. A destination for connecting with cultural heritage. The thriving area is remarkable to Asian Americans who grew up in the valley without a similar space. Sheila Yu sat down in Mekong Plaza's food court. She took a deep breath and looked around her, taking in the scattered solo diners and the elderly couple sharing a few dishes in silence. I do really love being here, Yu said. Having a space like this warms my heart a little bit. For Yu, a Chinese-American artist born and raised in Mesa, the space is a balm for the isolation and alienation she experienced as a child when she felt ashamed of her family and of being Asian. In 2024, Yu painted a mural on the side of the building of a dragon floating above hills lined with saguaro and yucca. It's her favorite mural she's ever painted. A lot of the other pieces, I don't think I get to really express this key component of my identity, of being Chinese American, and this experience of being raised in the Southwest and not having as much of a voice here, Yu said. Hawk also observed the Asian district bloom over the years. When he was a kid, he'd watch movies at the Tri-City Mall, which is across the street from where H Mart opened. Now, he visits roughly once a month to eat at Asian restaurants, the main significance of the area for him. First and foremost, it's food, he said. Hawk, who was born in Korea and adopted by white parents, said that the Asian restaurants he's been exposed to in the valley have influenced his cooking. At Valentine, for instance, he has served a take on Cantonese shrimp toast. He has a long list of his favorite dishes in the Asian district, which includes Soon Dobo, a spicy tofu stew with kimchi and pork from Hodori Restaurant, char siu pork from Asian Cafe Express, and anything with lamb from Shanxi Garden Restaurant. But for younger generations who have no memory of a time before the Asian district, its existence doesn't feel as new or exciting as it does to those like you and Hawk who grew up without it. Sophia Nguyen, 18, sat in Mekong's food court eating a bowl of shaved ice from Tea Snow. She comes around once a month with her family to grocery shop. It's just an Asian district that's been here for a while, Nguyen said. It's kind of just here. The fact that the Asian district is unremarkable to her is perhaps the best evidence of how the area has come to be a fixture of Asian American life in the valley. For Buchanan, making the hour-long drive from Santan Valley is worth it. She's originally from San Francisco, which has a much higher population of Vietnamese Americans, and the Asian district means a lot to her. If it wasn't here, I wouldn't have a place to go that would be like home. And that concludes our feature front page article this Sunday. That article was entitled Like Home, and that was by Rhea Lee. We'll move on now to a top story on scholarships entitled Scholarships Go to Often Overlooked Group, with the subtitle Helios Foundation Helps Transfer Students. This is by Eric Trevino. Jasmine Martinez remembers the day she arrived in Arizona. It was August 2015, and Martinez was moving to Levine from New York City. She was 27, had packed all her belongings into six suitcases, and had $4,000 to her name. When the airport elevator doors opened, she and her son were blasted by hot wind. Martinez looked down at her four-year-old son, and he was like, "Mommy, it's so hot." Immediately, she began to have doubts about moving. "I felt like I was failing my son. I felt hot. I felt frustrated," Martinez said. Martinez remembers having to walk a mile and a half in the Arizona summer with her son to the nearest bus station that first summer. As a single mom, she hoped Arizona would provide a better life for her child. She was determined to find the success she had been looking for, but was still struggling to stick with her education. "Being a single mom, unfortunately, we have a trajectory," Martinez said. Four times she had attempted to finish her associate degree, but never could stick with it. "Whether it was finances or scheduling, or if I'm being really honest, I just was not focused. I couldn't sit through seminars and do assignments and make sure my kid was picked up on time." On her fifth attempt, she decided it was going to be different. "As a parent, we're always making sure that others are taken care of," Martinez said. "I wanted to do something for me, and the only thing I could think of was school." Martinez didn't have a set plan. She just wanted to finish something she began long ago. Once she started working with disadvantaged young people, something clicked. She got a job as an administrative assistant for the Homeless Youth Outreach Program at Phoenix Children's Hospital, which brings health care services to homeless youth, and later as an assistant to the principal at a local high school. Both jobs allowed Martinez to work one-on-one with kids, and she realized she wanted to be a positive role model for them. "I see so much of the younger version of me that was so broken and so sad and so lonely," said Martinez. "I want to be someone that I did not have growing up." The challenges brought by moving to Arizona paid off. She felt she was providing her son a better life, and she completed her associate degree at Central Arizona College in Coolidge. When Martinez was accepted to Arizona State University, she was elated, but concerned about how she would be able to pay. That's when a scholarship opportunity from Helios Education Foundation caught her attention. Education Foundation offers help to transfer students. The Helios Education Foundation, a nonprofit focused on increasing access to education after high school in Arizona and Florida, celebrated its 20th anniversary by gifting 20 people scholarships of up to $20,000. The scholarships were exclusively for students transferring from a community college to an accredited four-year program. "We're celebrating by giving students some assistance to complete that last piece of their educational journey and attain that four-year degree," said Senior Vice President for Arizona Community Engagement Vince Yanez. "Many of them are adult learners, have a whole set of different needs, and might not have the same number of financial assistance opportunities available to them." Helios wanted to focus on transfer students for this scholarship opportunity because they are often overlooked when it comes to financial assistance. Most opportunities for financial assistance are only available to students enrolling in post-secondary education immediately after high school. The 20 recipients were chosen because they showed exceptional drive to complete their studies and were just in need of a financial leg up. Helios has a statewide post-secondary attainment goal. "Arizona cannot hit its attainment goal unless we do a better job of helping adult learners," Yanez said. Martinez, 36, said becoming an Arizona 20th Anniversary Pathway Scholar made her feel seen and recognized for her hard work. While it did not mean she could stop working as she continues her education, it will be one less thing to worry about, she said. She plans to pursue a degree in special education. Her personal experience with her son, who receives special education services, and her sister, who has Down syndrome, helped Martinez realize her desire to make sure all children get the proper education. While Martinez didn't have the support she needed in her primary school years, she found it later in life through Helios and Central Arizona College's Honor Society and wanted to pay it forward. "I need to be what I was just blessed with," Martina said, "with individuals that knew better, that could do better, that guided me, that walked me through the steps." Money offers DACA recipient chance to finish college. Susanna Nava, another Arizona 20th Anniversary Pathway Scholar, moved to Arizona from Morelos, Mexico when she was 5 years old. She was enrolled in the public education system and never questioned her immigration status. She was determined to go to college and earned dual enrollment credits throughout high school. After graduating, Nava continued her studies at Mesa Community College and was on a path to graduate when Senate Bill 1070 brought her studies to a halt. The bill, which was meant to encourage undocumented people to leave the state and was largely found unconstitutional in the courts, was signed into law in 2010. Nava's grades slipped because of the stress of the Show Me Your Papers law. Professors, she said, started advising her against pursuing her education further, as the bill could bring up challenges she might not be able to overcome. "They were trying to help me out and have me not stick out," Nava said, so she decided to drop out. "Not having that support really held me back as well and impacted my outlook as far as being able to actually get to that end goal," said Nava, age 37. "That also kind of shut down my voice at that time." In 2012, when President Barack Obama signed an executive order declaring deferred action for childhood arrivals, meaning people who migrated to the U.S. as children would not be prioritized for immigration enforcement, Nava was eligible for what has come to be called DACA status. Using her new status, she started working retail jobs until the program was interrupted by the first Donald Trump presidential administration. Aliento, a nonprofit organization that helps students, DACA recipients, and mixed-status families, reached out to Nava, and she went to one of its workshops. Nava started getting involved with Aliento and working with other people affected by immigration policies. "Through Aliento, Nava found her voice again," she said. "I needed to overcome that struggle and be able to surpass that barrier that was put in front of me," Nava said. She now works full-time helping other students ensure they get their post-secondary education regardless of their immigration status. "Since she has not finished college, the job has made her feel at odds with herself," she said. Nava decided that if she was going to be in a position to encourage others to finish school, it was only right for her to do the same. She enrolled in ASU's Business Administration program with the intention of using what she learned to help further Aliento's cause. "Aliento has become a really big part of my life, and especially because I'm an impacted person, I feel it's only right to pay back to the community that I'm part of," Nava said. Mayor designates Helios Education Foundation Day. Scholarship recipients and their family members were invited to an event on May 7th. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego attended and expressed gratitude for the opportunities Helios has brought to Arizonans, declaring May 7th, 2025, as Helios Education Foundation Day. "To the Helios team, congratulations on 2 decades of excellence," Gallego said. "You have changed so many lives and our entire state." And that article was entitled, "Scholarships Go to Often Overlooked Group," and that was by Eric Trevino. We're almost 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 1st, 2025. We're going to move on now to Valley and State News with this article entitled, "Phoenix Union Brings Telemedicine Services to Schools." This is by Eric Trevino. The Phoenix Union High School District is now offering telemedicine services to give students and staff quick healthcare access. The health services are intended to reduce absenteeism and improve well-being. With the new program, school community members can forego taking time away from campus to see their primary care provider and instead see a remote nurse practitioner from the school nurse's office. We're really hoping to see with this level of immediate care that it'll positively impact school attendance and staff attendance, said Phoenix Union Chief Achievement Officer Laura Tells. After Golden Health Initiative approached Phoenix Union about a partnership, the district wanted to choose pilot sites carefully before expanding the program district-wide. Golden Health Initiative is a company that aims to increase access to healthcare with its clinical services. The district surveyed student and staff families and found the two schools' communities showed significant interest in greater healthcare accessibility. The academies at South Mountain in South Phoenix and Alhambra High School in West Phoenix. Phoenix Union found the community surrounding the academies at South Mountain had insufficient access to nearby medical facilities, meaning many families had to drive to neighboring areas for care. Significant immigrant and refugee populations surround Alhambra, and Phoenix Union leaders thought telemedicine would make healthcare accessible in multiple languages. How Phoenix Union's new telemedicine service will work. Students visiting their school nurse's office at South Mountain and Alhambra High Schools can now receive telemedicine services, including behavioral and mental health services, if their parents have signed Phoenix Union consent forms. Golden Health Initiative accepts all insurances, including Medicaid, said Christine Carvalho, the company's acting CEO. Medicaid in Arizona is offered through the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, commonly called ACCESS. Nurses at the school will work with a remote nurse practitioner using kits provided by 19 labs that are basically an emergency room in a box, Carvalho said. The kits are equipped with diagnostic tools such as a thermometer, an oximeter, and a blood pressure monitor. Another component is an exam camera that allows the nurse practitioner to look into the throat, nose, and ears. The equipment is Bluetooth compatible, so the nurse practitioner can read vitals while the nurse examines the student. From there, the nurse practitioner can prescribe the student medicine or refer them to a specialist. It can all be done and integrated into the school day or immediately afterwards, and education doesn't suffer, said Lisette Poletta, a spokesperson for 19 Labs. Plans to expand access to families of students, staff. The telemedicine services were only offered in the spring 2025 semester to students and staff during school hours, but Phoenix Union is looking to expand hours and coverage so family members can also take advantage of the services after school or on weekends beginning in June. Golden Health Initiative and Phoenix Union are considering bringing telemedicine services to all of the district's schools before January 2026 and are looking to introduce a physical clinic where people can receive hands-on care and advanced testing. And that article was entitled, Phoenix Union Brings Telemedicine Services to Schools, and that was by Eric Trevino. Our next article is entitled, Average to Wetter Than Normal Monsoon is Forecast. This is by Perry Vandell. It's a dry heat, maybe something Arizonans living in the southern and central parts of the state say to themselves and others to justify living in a place where opening the front door can feel similar to opening an oven, but it's not always the case. Though many of the state's summer days can feel like walking on the surface of the sun, some can feel noticeably different during Arizona monsoon season, which begins in mid-June and goes through September. What would have been an 116-degree day could be 106 instead, with higher humidity and potential dust storms to contend with. The National Weather Service recently released its outlook for the 2025 monsoon to give people an idea of what to expect as summer approaches. Here's what to know. 2024 monsoon was abnormally dry in Phoenix area. The 2024 Arizona monsoon season had stark contrast throughout the state, as the northern and southeastern parts received near to above normal precipitation, although the Phoenix region fell well below normal levels, according to a video presentation the agency's Tucson office posted on YouTube. This, along with an abnormally dry winter, left much of the state at a level of extreme drought, the Weather Service said. As of May 20th, much of northern Arizona was in moderate to severe drought, with a small portion of the Four Corners region being only abnormally dry, the lightest drought level. While abnormally dry conditions have limited the growth of grass and brush, they have also dried out vegetation that remains even further. Dry lightning or thunderstorms that lack much precipitation or were expected to be the main trigger behind wildfires at the beginning of the monsoon. The Weather Service said Arizona typically sees over 500,000 lightning strikes per season, with them typically occurring between noon and the early evening. Above normal precipitation projected across the state. In terms of actual rainfall, Arizona could see roughly 2 inches in lower deserts, including the Phoenix area, and up to 16 inches in mountain ranges. Metro Phoenix typically experiences about 10 days with measurable rainfall during the monsoon, while the higher mountainous areas see roughly 30 to 50 days of rainfall. The Weather Service projected Phoenix with a 43% chance of above normal precipitation during the monsoon, a 33% chance of near normal precipitation, and a 24% chance of having below normal precipitation. For context, Phoenix had an average of 2.43 inches of rainfall during monsoon seasons from 1991 through 2020, according to the Weather Service. Other cities that lean toward having above normal rain included Tucson, Flagstaff, Prescott, Kingman, and Sholo, among others. The Weather Service recommended people check their local forecasts before going out and ensure they're signed up to receive weather warnings. That article was entitled, Average to Wetter Than Normal Monsoon is Forecast, and that was by Perry Vandell. Our next article is entitled, How Does Marijuana Get Tested in Arizona? This is by Ray Stern. Dispensaries have to test samples of the marijuana and THC-infused products they sell in Arizona for potency and contaminants like pesticides. That doesn't mean everything consumers purchase at a dispensary is pure. The system is far from perfect, meaning products may have more impurities or less THC than buyers expect. The state is currently targeting two marijuana testing labs for enforcement, one for alleged slipshod methods and bad record keeping, the other for an alleged conflict of interest. But a 2019 state law allows consumers to enjoy their favorite brand of flower, shatter, or infused gummies without too much worry. Here's how Arizona's marijuana testing rules work. Testing started a decade after legalization. Voters legalized medical marijuana in 2010, but the new law didn't include mandatory product testing. A few testing companies opened for dispensaries that wanted to offer customers a potency rating on a product's label and protect customers from contaminants that could hurt them and hurt business. Lawmakers unanimously passed a law in 2019 that was signed by former Republican Governor Doug Ducey requiring testing. The law took effect in 2020. That same year, voters approved the state's recreational marijuana law permitting all adults 21 and older to use and possess personal amounts of marijuana or cannabis concentrates like the hash oil and cannabis-infused vape pens. The recreational law adopted essentially the same testing regime as the 2019 law. What does the law do? The 2019 law requires products to be tested for unsafe levels of microbial contamination like mold, heavy metals like lead and mercury, pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, growth regulators, and residual solvents. The test must also confirm the potency of marijuana for sale. Customers can request the certificates of analysis for tested products at any time, and it must be turned over. Some dispensaries or cannabis brands list the certificates on their websites. The law puts the Arizona Department of Health Services, which oversees the state's medical and recreational marijuana programs, in charge of licensing and inspecting independent third-party laboratories to do the testing. To prevent corruption, those labs are banned from being tied financially or through family relations to operators of dispensaries. Labs get state oversight, but the state doesn't directly test marijuana or confirm a lab's results. Instead, officials must ensure the labs are meeting appropriate standards in science, quality control, and record keeping. Has all marijuana sold in Arizona been tested? No. The law requires dispensaries to test samples of batches of marijuana products to be sold. For example, growers select samples of plants grown from seeds or cuttings that were planted and harvested at the same time. Samples of edibles would be taken from batches of the same ingredients made at the same time. What are the penalties for violating the law? The state health agency director can revoke or suspend a marijuana testing company's license to operate if it is not in substantial compliance with the state's testing rules. Companies can receive fines of up to $1,000 per day per violation of the rules. But the maximum assessed fine can be no more than $5,000 in a 30-day period. What do testing labs look for? Labs can search for specific components in a sample or do a full panel test. The tests look for microbial contaminants like E. coli, Aspergillus, Salmonella, as well as potentially harmful foreign substances like metals, pesticides left over from the growing process, or solvents that can remain when marijuana flower is processed into concentrates like shatter, wax, or vape pen oil. The tests also check the percentage of the cannabinoids in the products, usually delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, more commonly known as THC. The tests will also pick up percentages of other cannabinoids like cannabidiol, which is known as CBD. Under state rules, the potency percentage found by the tests must match the percentage on labels for the same products within plus or minus 20% or be repackaged to meet the standard. What happens when contaminants are found? Dispensaries can order retests for items found with contaminants. In some cases, they can remediate the products. For instance, if marijuana flower is found to contain Aspergillus, it can still have its cannabinoids extracted. That essentially turns the flower into hashish oil that can be used in vaporizer devices, edibles, or infused drinks. However, no remediation is possible with Salmonella, certain toxic molds, or other substances. Products that cannot be remediated must be destroyed, and those already on store shelves can be recalled. That article was entitled, How Does Marijuana Get Tested in Arizona? And that was by Ray Stern. We're going to move on to national and world news with articles from USA Today. With a couple of front page articles, one on Trump getting a key win on migrants and the other on Hamas and Gaza. So the first article is entitled, Trump Gets Key Wins on Migrants, with a subtitle, Supreme Court OKs His Hardline Policies Despite Misgivings. This is by Andrew Chung. The U.S. Supreme Court swept away last week another obstacle to one of President Donald Trump's most aggressively pursued policies, mass deportation, again showing its willingness to back his hardline approach to immigration. The justices, though, have signaled some reservations with how he is carrying it out. Since Trump returned to the White House in January, the court already has been called upon to intervene on an emergency basis in 7 legal fights over his crackdown on immigration. It most recently let Trump's administration end temporary legal status provided to hundreds of thousands of migrants for humanitarian reasons by his Democratic predecessor Joe Biden, while legal challenges in 2 cases play out in lower courts. The Supreme Court on May 30th lifted a judge's order that had halted the revocation of immigration parole for more than 500,000 Venezuelan, Cuban, Haitian, and Nicaraguan migrants. On May 19th, it lifted another judge's order preventing the termination of temporary protected status for more than 300,000 Venezuelan migrants. In some other cases, however, the justices have ruled that the administration must treat migrants fairly as required under the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of due process. This president has been more aggressive than any in modern U.S. history to quickly remove non-citizens from the country, said Kevin Johnson, an immigration and public interest law expert at the University of California, Davis. No president in modern history has been as willing to deport non-citizens without due process, Johnson added. That dynamic has forced the Supreme Court to police the contours of the administration's actions, if less so, the legality of Trump's underlying policies. The court's 6-3 conservative majority includes three justices appointed by Trump during his first term as president. President Trump is acting within his lawful authority to deport illegal aliens and protect the American people. While the Supreme Court has rightfully acknowledged the president's authority in some cases, in others, they've invented new due process rights for illegal aliens that will make America less safe. We are confident in the legality of our actions and will continue fighting to keep President Trump's promises, White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson told Reuters. The justices twice, on April 7th and on May 15th, have placed limits on the administration's attempt to implement Trump's invocation of a 1798 law called the Alien Enemies Act, which historically has been employed only in wartime, to swiftly deport Venezuelan migrants who it is accused of being members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Lawyers and family members of some of the migrants have disputed the gang membership allegation. On May 16th, the justices also said a bid by the administration to deport migrants from a detention center in Texas failed basic constitutional requirements. Giving migrants notice roughly 24 hours before removal, devoid of information about how to exercise due process rights to contest that removal, surely does not pass muster, the court said. Due process generally requires the government to provide notice and an opportunity for a hearing before taking certain adverse actions. The court has not outright barred the administration from pursuing these deportations under the Alien Enemies Act, as the justices have yet to decide the legality of using the law for this purpose. The U.S. government last invoked the Alien Enemies Act during World War II to intern and deport people of Japanese, German, and Italian descent. The Supreme Court has, in several cases, reaffirmed some basic principles of constitutional law, including that due process clause applies to all people on U.S. soil, said Elora Mukherjee, director of Columbia Law School's Immigrants' Rights Clinic. Even for alleged gang members, Mukherjee said, the court has been extremely clear that they are entitled to notice before they could be summarily deported from the United States. Wrongly deported man. In a separate case, the court on April 10th ordered the administration to facilitate the release from custody in El Salvador of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran migrant who was living in Maryland. The administration has acknowledged that Abrego Garcia was wrongly deported to El Salvador. The administration has yet to return Abrego Garcia to the United States, which, according to some critics, amounts to defiance of the Supreme Court. The administration deported on March 15th more than 200 people to El Salvador, where they were detained in the country's massive anti-terrorism prison under a deal in which the United States is paying President Nayib Bukele's government $6 million. Ilya Sumin, a constitutional law professor at George Mason University, said the Supreme Court overall has tried to curb the administration's more extreme and most blatantly illegal policies without abandoning its traditional deference to presidential authority on immigration issues. I think they have made a solid effort to strike a balance, said Salmon, referring to the Alien Enemies Act and Abrego-Garcia cases. But I still think there is excessive deference and a tolerance for things that would not be permitted outside the immigration field. That deference was on display over the past 2 weeks, with the court's decisions letting Trump terminate the grants of temporary protected status and humanitarian parole previously given to migrants. Such consequential orders were issued without the court offering any reasoning, Mukherjee noted. Collectively, those two decisions strip immigration status and legal protections in the United States from more than 800,000 people. And the decisions are devastating for the lives of those who are affected, Mukherjee said. Those individuals could be subject to deportations, family separation, losing their jobs, and if they're deported, possibly even losing their lives. That article is entitled Trump Gets Key Wins on Migrants, and that was by Andrew Chung. Now in world news, this second front page article from the USA Today is entitled Hamas Seeks Changes to U.S. Gaza Proposal. The subtitle is UN Warns Humanitarian Situation Worse Than Ever. This is by Nidal al-Maghrabi and James McKenzie. Hamas said May 31st it was seeking amendments to a U.S.-backed proposal for a temporary ceasefire with Israel and Gaza, but President Donald Trump's envoy rejected the group's response as totally unacceptable. The Palestinian militant group said it was willing to release 10 living hostages and hand over the bodies of 18 dead in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons. But Hamas reiterated demands for an end to the war and withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, conditions Israel has rejected. A Hamas official described the group's response to the proposals from Trump's special Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff as positive, but said it was seeking some amendments. The official did not elaborate on the changes being sought. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that while his government had agreed to Witkoff's outline, Hamas was continuing its rejection of the plan. Israel will continue its action for the return of our hostages and the defeat of Hamas, he said in a statement. Earlier in the day, May 31st, Hamas issued a statement saying, "This response aims to achieve a permanent ceasefire, a complete withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and to ensure the flow of humanitarian aid to our people in the Strip." The proposals would see a 60-day truce and the exchange of 28 of the 58 hostages still held in Gaza for more than 1,200 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, along with the entry of humanitarian aid into the enclave. Senior Hamas official Bassem Naim later denied any rejection of Witkoff's proposal, but said Israel's response was incompatible with what had been agreed to and accused the U.S. envoy of acting with complete bias in favor of Israel. A Palestinian official familiar with the talks told Reuters that among amendments Hamas is seeking is the release of the hostages in three phases over the 60-day truce and more aid distribution in different areas. Hamas also wants guarantees the deal will lead to a permanent ceasefire, the official said. Israel has previously rejected Hamas's conditions, instead demanding the complete disarmament of the group and its dismantling as a military and governing force, along with the return of all 58 remaining hostages. Trump said May 30th that he believed a ceasefire agreement was close after the latest proposals, and the White House said May 29th that Israel had agreed to the terms. Saying he had received Hamas's response, Witkoff wrote in a posting on X, "It is totally unacceptable and only takes us backward. Hamas should accept the framework proposal we put forward as the basis for proximity talks, which we can begin immediately this coming week." On May 31st, the Israeli military said it had killed Mohammed Sinwar, Hamas's Gaza chief, on May 13th, confirming what Netanyahu said last week. Sinwar, the younger brother of Yahya Sinwar, the group's deceased leader and mastermind of the October 2023 attack on Israel, was the target of an Israeli strike on a hospital in southern Gaza. Hamas has neither confirmed nor denied his death. The Israeli military, which relaunched its air and ground campaign in March after a two-month truce, said May 31st it was continuing to hit targets in Gaza, including sniper posts, and had killed what it said was the head of a Hamas weapons manufacturing site. The campaign has cleared large areas along the boundaries of the Gaza Strip, squeezing the population of more than 2 million into an ever narrower section along the coast and around the southern city of Khan Yunis. Israel imposed a blockade on all supplies entering the enclave at the beginning of March in an effort to weaken Hamas, and has found itself under increasing pressure from an international community shocked by the desperate humanitarian situation the blockade has created. On Saturday, aid groups said dozens of World Food Program trucks carrying flour to Gaza bakeries had been hijacked by armed groups and subsequently looted by people desperate for food after weeks of mounting hunger. After nearly 80 days of a total blockade, communities are starving and they are no longer willing to watch food pass them by, the WFP said in a statement. The incident was the latest in a series that has underscored the shaky security situation hampering the delivery of aid into Gaza following the easing of a weeks-long Israeli blockade earlier this month. The United Nations said May 30th that the situation in Gaza is the worst since the start of the war 19 months ago, with the entire population facing the risk of famine despite a resumption of limited aid deliveries earlier this month. The aid that's being sent now makes a mockery of the mass tragedy unfolding under our watch, Philippe Lazzarini, head of the main UN Relief Organization for Palestinians, said in a message on X. Israel has been allowing a limited number of trucks from the World Food Program and other international groups to bring flour to bakeries in Gaza, but deliveries have been hampered by repeated incidents of looting. And that is all the time that we have for this article entitled Hamas Seeks Changes to U.S. Gaza Proposal. That was by Nadal Al-Maghrabi and James McKenzie. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 1st, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.